Senator.
All the February 10th meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation to order. Welcome everybody to the committee. We're going to start off with Senate Bill 5. So we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5. And James, you want to do an introduction?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 5 designates portion of State Highway 126 between Florence and Eugene as William Tebow Memorial Highway. Directs Department of Transportation to erect and maintain markers along highway described above. There is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact, and no amendments.
Thank you, Mr. President. Welcome to our committee. Whenever you're ready, sir.
My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator from District 11, which includes portions of Salem, Drewes, Woodburn. And Chair Lee Beyer, Vice Chair Fred Gerard, and members, what few members of the Transportation Committee that are here. Thank you for allowing me to come and testify before your committee today. And I know, Senator, the Chair and the Vice Chair are mad at me, but I hope that you will consider this memorial on its face and its merits. It's an extraordinary piece of work. I introduced this bill, and I come here today to ask you to support Senate Bill 5. This measure would name a portion of a state highway, specifically Highway 126, the William Tebow Memorial Highway. William Bill Tebow is a true Oregonian. He was raised in Baker City, of course, Eastern Oregon. He was an engineer and a pioneer. He was an Eagle Scout. He was a husband, a father, a grandfather, and great-grandfather. And Mr. William Bill Tebow made Oregon a better place. He and his family deserve this honor. Mr. William Tebow was the first African-American man to attend Oregon State College, which today is the Oregon State University. Tired of Ohio State saying the. Now on, my only the is the Oregon State University. He graduated in 1948, and he overcame prejudice none of us could have imagined today. As an African American at Oregon State College, he was denied housing, and he had to work tending a fraternity house furnace in exchange for a basement room. He was not one to complain. He worked hard, he overcame injustice, and he graduated with an engineering degree from the Oregon State University. Mr. Tebow spent his career in public service, and he worked for the Oregon Department of Transportation for 36 years. He pioneered the department's first hydraulic design unit. He contributed to many of the highways and bridges we use today in the great state of Oregon. He taught engineering for 30 years at Temecula Community College, and he was named Teacher of the Year in 1970 there. William Bill Tebow has been honored by his peers, his colleagues, and his community. Books have been written about him. He is in the Engineering Hall of Fame at the Oregon State University. Despite being denied housing at Oregon State College in the 40s, it is extraordinary that in 2014, the Oregon State University would name a residence hall after him. So symbolically, today he is admitted to the great university. And today, instead of when he arrived on campus and they saw that he was a person of color saying, there is no place in the end in our residence hall for you. There is no place. That is what they told him. Today, they don't want to give him a place in their residence hall. They have named a residence hall after him. Now is the time for the legislature to recognize him. With this naming, we will be showing our respect and our appreciation for the many things that William Bill Tebow did and gave to this great state. And I might add, to Oregon State University. I thank you, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair, the Ohio State University Gerard, and other members of this committee for allowing me to come here and testify today.
Thank you,
questions, comments, or criticisms?
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a serious memorial. I would love to cross-examine the President of the Senate, since I don't have a chance very often, but this is a very good bill, and I think I'll be quiet.
We'll let it go on this time. Thank you very much for bringing this bill to us.
And I'm enjoying that we'll be testifying today. His wonderful daughter, Sherry, and Denny will be here. They are here. The Oregon State University has sent Scott Ashford, who happens to be the dean of the College of Engineering, and Matt Garrett himself, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, is here to also testify on this remarkable memorial.
Thank you, Mr. President.
You have no questions for me?
We have none for you today.
Are you willing to come back at another time?
We have lots of questions, but not about this bill. Thank you. Mr. Garrett. Are there others you want to bring up with you, Matt?
Mr. Chairman, I'm fine. I think we can bring the family up by themselves.
Okay.
I think that would be more than appropriate. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Matthew Garrett, the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I think Mr. Labar did a great job of outlining and summarizing the discipline and the role ODOT will play with this honor. Bottom line, I want to share a few thoughts, and President Courtney touched on many. But it certainly is a privilege for me to be here today representing my agency to celebrate and honor a great man. We at ODOT embrace the language contained in Senate Bill 5. William Bill Tebow created a professional and personal legacy at the Oregon Department of Transportation. During his 36-year career, he was responsible for numerous improvements in the disciplines of construction, design, planning, and mapping. He was indeed a man of courage, of intellect, and of inspiration. He understood and modeled the belief that public service is a noble cause, and that success is truly realized through the betterment of others. He lived that. Clearly a man of many talents, but I believe at his core he was always a teacher. And what Bill is remembered for by several generations of engineers at ODOT right now and those that have moved on was his love of teaching and mentoring young engineers. He was instrumental in assisting the Association of Engineering Employees in developing a study guide for the state examinations for the disciplines of engineering and highway engineering positions. So put simply, he is personally responsible for helping hundreds of young people, young engineers in the state of Oregon to obtain their engineering license, which indeed is the ultimate goal of any young engineer. Mr. Tebow's commitment to education, personal development, and mentorship has indeed left a legacy for the state of Oregon as well as the ODOT family. Again, I conclude, Mr. Chair, by saying it is a privilege for me to be here. It is a privilege for the Oregon Department of Transportation to be part of honoring the legacy of William Bill Tebow with the designation of Oregon 126 from US 101 in Florence to the Beltline Highway in Eugene. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand down and take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Gurna. My understanding is that the significance of using this particular stretch of highway is that Mr. Tebow was instrumental in a lot of the bridges and the roads there.
I think that's exactly right. His fingerprints are on that. It all centers around the Fern Ridge Reservoir. It's the dam they built. That changed the hydraulic realities within that area, it's the drainage, and tested some of the infrastructure. Along that, Mr. Tebow put his fingerprints on that, looking at 21 bridges across this corridor, analyzing the various land use issues, hydraulic issues, And he really touched the character and the nature of the highway, and I would submit the transportation area around this dam area. So it's it is more than appropriate, it is right and just that his fingerprints are on this section of highway, and we honor him with the designation.
I've driven that road many, many times, and that is a tricky piece of engineering there. So
it certainly
is. I think that sounds like it's very appropriate.
Mr. Chairman, 21 bridges. He did all the analysis on them, less than 1 year. I'm not sure we could do that today. And that certainly speaks to the intellect of the man right now.
I'm not sure you can do any road project in less than 1 year.
Very well said, Mr. Chairman. Very well said.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Garrett? Thank you, Director Garrett. Most appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Tebow, and any other members of your family, if you'd like to testify, that would be wonderful.
Sure. I have other family members, so Janine and my sister Denny and her husband.
Well, you're welcome to come forward or not. Your choice.
They say no. They don't want to come.
We really don't bite. We're pretty far away.
I've got Craig Campbell with me also. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sherry Tebow. I am one of Bill Tebow's seven children, six girls, one boy. I'm on behalf of our lovely mother and daddy's wife, Genevieve, and the entire Tebow family, I would like to sincerely thank Representative Comp and Senator Courtney for sponsoring this bill. I'd also like to thank ODOT, OSU, Oregon Northwest Black Pioneers, in which daddy was honored by, Craig Campbell and Michael Doherty, who's a friend of our family, for their support. Daddy was an engineer and a pioneer. He treasured his 36-year career at ODOT and his teaching career at Chemeketa. He just loved it. And he also stayed connected to OSU throughout his entire life. He was a true beaver. Michael Doherty, a friend of our family, who is a basketball coach in the state and a graduate of OSU, sorry, and a freelance writer, became interested in Daddy's life story several years ago. And he has published several articles about Daddy's journey, which led to a lot of other information about Dad. I contacted Mr. Doherty to let him know of this bill, and I'd like to read his response. He wrote, "Thanks for letting me know about the William Tebow Memorial Highway. I can't describe how pleased I am about the honors that have been created in your dad's name. He lived his life doing considerable service and good work without expecting special recognition. I know, as I have said before, that Bill loved his job and was intent on doing quality work. That was his expectation for himself and the reason that I and others who knew him admired him so much. He was the kind of person all of us should aspire to be. Researching and writing about his life has been a tremendous opportunity and a valuable life lesson for me. I am so glad to have known him and to have had my family develop an ongoing relationship with his family." And that was Michael Doherty. Again, I offer our thanks to you all. We are sure that Daddy is rejoicing with us about the legacy that this bill creates. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any comments or questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. It's my great honor to be representing the family in support of the bill. I don't have to add anything to the bill except to say that very seldom do we have an opportunity to recognize those people who put their lives into developing our transportation infrastructure, and to have been able to find somebody who has left such a legacy and has such a direct connection not only with OSU, the state as a whole, but this particular highway. It certainly makes great sense for us to be able to recognize those people when we can find them, especially when we have an individual of this caliber. And I have to say, working with the family, just such a phenomenal legacy in the family that that he raised.
Thank you very much. Anybody else? No comment? Thank you. I see somebody else jumping up here, so I got a suspicion that's someone from OSU by the color of the tie.
Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, my name is Scott Ashford. I am the Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University. I also grew up in Salem. I attended North Salem, and the Tebows were family friends. And I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to know Bill Tebow personally. It's an honor to appear to you before your committee today and support Senate Bill 5 and for naming a part of Highway 121 in honor of William Tebow. You know, as Senator Courtney said, he was admitted to Oregon State in 1943, and when they realized he was black, we denied him housing. The dean of students at the time actually suggested he might be better off at another university. But he was able to get a room in the basement of a fraternity in exchange for attending the Furnace. And he graduated from our College of Engineering in 1948 and became an engineer. He was a man who overcame significant adversity, and yet he stayed connected to his alma mater his entire life. And I'm very proud to call him a true Beaver. He was a dedicated engineer who left his mark throughout the state. He inspired others through his teaching to also become engineers. He was a man of the community, a community leader, and a tireless advocate for access and for education. And maybe more importantly, he was a family man who had a wife and 7 children and gave his love to his many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. In recent years, a number of recognitions have been made for Bill Tebow. In 2010, we honored him as entered into the our College of Engineering Hall of Fame. The Oregon Black Pioneers gave him the Trailblazer Award in 2010. And then just this past fall, we named one of our residence halls in his honor. Yet, as an engineer myself and as an Oregonian, I can think of no better or appropriate honor than for the state to recognize this man and his contributions and his quiet resilience by dedicating a portion of Highway 126 in his honor. Bill Tebow's lasting impact on the state and his contributions to supporting access, education, and transportation safety for all Oregonians, regardless of color of their skin, should be so recognized. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean. Any comments, questions? Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 5, Senate Resolution 5? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 5. And the chair moves Senate Bill 5 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 5 is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation by unanimous agreement. And we will ask Senator Courtney to carry the bill. Thank you for coming today. We'll close on that, and we will open I think we'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 273. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 273 requires the acceptance of guaranteed auto protection, or GAP, or credit insurance coverage from sources other than where the vehicle or property item is purchased, standardizes method for total loss calculation for GAP policy settlements, establishes separate listing of insurance charges from other loan charges, limits coverage period from beginning to end of loan transaction, restricts charges to period of effective coverage, requires notice of coverage renewal or cancellation, declares emergency effective upon passage. There are no revenue or fiscal impacts to this bill, and there are no amendments.
Thank you. Commissioner Colley, there we are. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Laura Calley. I'm sorry, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Laura Calley. I'm the insurance commissioner for DCBS. And with me is Gail Gage, who's a senior policy analyst with the insurance division as well. And so she's available as we get into some of the technical details. So today I'm here before you to talk about Senate Bill 273. And Senate Bill 273 has to do with a set of insurance issues around credit policies and gap insurance protection. And these are some specific products that are sold to consumers at the time that they're entering into a financial transaction to buy a car or maybe to buy a piece of furniture. And what can happen sometimes when a consumer is engaging in that decision to take out a loan is there can be some high-pressure sales situations where they're being either required to buy insurance or offered the opportunity to buy insurance that will protect protect the difference between the loan balance and the value of the property that they buy. And the bill deals with a couple of different things, but I'm going to focus first on gap insurance. I think that that's something that's kind of familiar to many folks. If you've bought a car, you've likely been offered this kind of a product. And the concept is that a gap insurance product, it's called, it stands for Guaranteed Auto Protection. And it's sold to someone who's financing a vehicle to protect them in the event of a total loss where the value of the car that they're reimbursed by their insurer or by a third party who's liable is actually not enough to cover the loan balance. And so it's an insurance product that helps fill that gap. And sometimes this is required at the time that someone is entering into a loan. Sometimes it's optional. And what can occur is that if you're sitting there, you know, you're actually getting ready to sign the paperwork for a loan, you don't necessarily have a lot of time to think about, well, could I actually go buy this insurance product maybe from the insurer that I already purchased my auto insurance from? Maybe I had the opportunity to shop this. And that can be the case if it's required or if it's optional. And there, you know, it's really not an opportunity for a consumer to have a lot of time to think through and walk through what the terms of that insurance would be. And something similar also occurs when people might engage in buying, you know, a piece of furniture or financing something else. And what we're proposing to do with Senate Bill 273 is to enhance some consumer protections and some disclosures to help consumers understand their options and have a little bit more time and flexibility to make the decisions that make most financial sense for them. And what we're proposing here draws heavily on a model law that the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has put out. There are some modifications here that we think are, you know, helpful to consumers around giving them enhanced disclosures, giving them time to actually, you know, have a free look at a policy that they're being offered at the time of sale, and that they have the opportunity to then make a different decision, you know, buy from maybe someone who's offering the same product for less. I'm going to just highlight a couple of the key provisions of the bill, and I'd be happy to take questions after I run through some of those. So I've mentioned that we would enhance disclosures, and we would actually propose that it would be the responsibility of the producers or the agents to disclose the limitations and the scope of credit insurance coverage, so, you know, helping consumers better understand what it does and what it doesn't cover. I mentioned that we're proposing a 30-day free look period during which, you know, consumer could decide that they actually want to go elsewhere with their business after the time of purchase. Limiting the coverage so that it only applies from the beginning of the loan to the end of the loan, and also eliminating coverage at the time that that there's a total loss or the loan is ended. So we've actually seen situations where someone might continue to be charged premium even after the loan has been fully satisfied. And a couple of other things around requiring fair notice of renewal or cancellation of the policies, limiting the commissions on these policies to no more than 35% of the premium, and also limiting the charge for the insurance to the amount of the net debt that's actually covered on the contract. And so that's just some of the highlights that we're looking at. We know that there may be some interested parties, I think more focused on kind of the consumer finance side of things, that have some questions or concerns, and we've had some preliminary conversations with them, and we're also committed to working with them on what their issues might be. And I will stop there and happy to answer any questions.
So, Commissioner, usually the gap policies are only in place for a short period of time, and I'm thinking primarily around cars, and it's the proverbial, you drive the new car off the lot, have an accident, and all of a sudden it's the replacement insurance is only 80% of what your loan is at that period of time. So, but usually about after 6 to 12 months, you've got that gap closed. Does this deal with that at all?
Chair Beyer, so yes, it can be short term, but there also are some situations where if maybe you've actually turned in another vehicle and you had a balance on the loan and you've rolled that balance into a new loan and then you purchase a new vehicle, and so you might actually end up with a situation where your loan it's not just reflecting the purchase price of the car when you bought it, but the balance on your prior loan, and so your gap can be wider. There can be situations where it can be a bit lengthier, but the, you know, the proposal here is that, you know, at the time, you know, that really, at the time that there's really no value left to the product, I think that, you know, consumers would have the opportunity to cancel that. And certainly if it's no longer needed, where, you know, there was a, the car has been, you know, has been sold, or, you know, otherwise the loan's been extinguished, that they wouldn't have to continue paying premium on that.
Okay. Questions? Is the commissioner? No. Okay.
Thank
Guess
you very
not.
Much.
Okay. Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, Oregon Bankers, Oregon Financial Services, American Insurance Association, and Nationwide Insurance. All of those entities, plus others, actually have some concerns about this bill, and we have spoken. I've spoken at some length with Ms. Calley and her staff, and have committed to sit down and work through those. Some of these have to do with the fact that we believe, taking a model that's only been adopted in whole by two states, even though it's been around for a number of years, and adding a bunch of other things may have, in fact, unintentionally encumbered this bill with effects on commercial small community bank lending, which was not, as you could hear, their goal, and a number of other effects that broaden it well beyond what I think the scope as explained to you is. And we're happy to sit down and work with that. On behalf of Ms. Levitt, she authorized me a moment ago to say that she's willing to be part of this work group and anxious to work with us in trying to find some solutions that meet the goals of the insurance division without encumbering a lot of other transactions that are not intended to be encumbered. But I think we have a good deal of work to do on it, actually, to slim it down to where it needs to be.
Okay. Thank you. Questions, Paul? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who wishes to talk on this bill? I haven't got anybody else signed up. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 273, and we will hold it over for a couple of weeks to allow you to get together and talk about it. Okay, so we'll move on then. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 277.
Mr. James. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 277 enables Department of Consumer and Business Services to transition the money transmission, debt management service provider, and check cashing programs onto the nationwide mortgage licensing system and registry. Allows the department via rule to modify licensing practices, procedures, and information to meet registry requirement. Aligns licensing or registration statutes in each program area to be based on the calendar year for first year licensing or registration and subsequent renewals. Declares emergency effective on passage, becomes operative 91 days after effective date of measure. There are no fiscal or revenue impacts, and there are no amendments.
Thank you, and I have Mr. Tapman. Mr. Blackwell. Yeah, thank please. You.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Tapman, and to my right, your left, is Richard Blackwell. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is a committee, or excuse me, an agency within the Department of Consumer and Business Services, similar to what Ms. Calley's position is for the Insurance Division. We are here today on Senate Bill 277, and so first of all, thank you for hearing that. This is really a fairly technical matter. As your administrator said, we're looking to streamline the licensing process for three of our programs. Our division is charged with the oversight of 13 different programs, and many of them are located solely within Oregon. But within a subsection of that are non-depository programs. We have about 10 different programs, many of which involves licensing people that are in state, but also outside the state. Our system has been one where we started with paper, and now we, in the last 10 years, we've tried to streamline that using our computer system. That system's 10 years old, and we're in a process of having to replace that. So we think, just from a fiscal perspective, that it makes sense to use this new federal system. I misspeak. It's not federal. It's national. So the NMLS was started when Congress required all mortgage loan originators to become licensed throughout the country. This was in response to the economic downturn in 2007, 2008. And they mandated that there be a single licensing process. And so the NMLS, the National Mortgage Licensing System, as it was known then, was created to allow for a one-stop shopping licensing system. And so people would file there, and then depending on what states they wanted to be licensed in, the applications would be sent to us, those respective states. They also did background checks at the same time. They processed the money that was received at the same time, and now they're also handling annual reports and so forth. So it's really a fantastic system for one-stop shopping. As time progressed, we saw the benefits of this, and a number of national companies saw the benefits of being able to do this at one time. And so although all 50 states were doing this for loan originators, a number of states decided they wanted to start using the system for other areas. And since that began in the last 4 years, we now see 38 different licensing agencies across the country licensing more than 100 different types of licenses. And in fact, the state of Oregon, our agency, is already doing that for a subset, the consumer finance licenses. We did this last year. We had the authority to do that. Their license type matched up well with what the NMLS requires. So we had 125 people licensed through the process, and then this year they renewed it. 124 of the 125 renewed it. One chose not to renew it. That's our option, obviously. But both in terms of the loan originator and in terms of our now consumer finance, it has proven to be a very effective process. And so we're asking that we add these three other categories of licenses: money transmitters, check cashers, and debt management service providers. And the reason we're here before you today is because a few years ago, when those were established as a certain licensing requirement, they were given a 2-year window of time. And so that meant the license was good for 2 years, and they were licensed as of the date they applied or the date they were approved, which meant we had dates all across the calendar. Well, the NMLS system, just for ease of being streamlined and effective, requires that they be 1-year licenses, and at the end of 1 year, the renewal date is the 1st of January of each year. So we're asking this body to make those changes, or give us the authority to make those changes. In fact, we're asking for those changes from you. It has to be done by the legislature to allow us to then allow these three areas to go on to the system. So maybe that's more than you wanted to know, but that's a technical fix for us. It will allow us to be more effective and save time and money in terms of processing these licenses, and allow, as I say, national organizations to be able to do this one-stop shopping. There is one other thing in here, and if you've got the bill in front of you, it's a policy issue that we have presented to this group, because we want some direction on how to proceed, and that is on page 5 of the bill, section 6, subsection 10, you'll see a definition for money. Well, most of us, just like the famous Supreme Court judge says, I know it when I see it. We all know what money is, but the reality is money is no longer what it used to be. It is currency for sure. It's U.S. currency and foreign currency, but it's also becoming something that is not fiat-based, that is not government-based. And we're talking about, in the vernacular, cryptocurrencies. For most of us, that would be Bitcoin, but there are certainly a lot of others besides Bitcoins that is being used in lieu of money. I don't know if you've seen this, but I really had my eyes open when I went up to Portland at Christmas time, went to the Pioneer Mall, and down in the food court, there was a Bitcoin money exchange in there. You could buy Bitcoins. Now, I don't know which one of those fast food servicers were actually taking Bitcoins, but it just means that they're becoming much more present. Now, I don't know that Bitcoin will be around tomorrow, and we're not asking to define Bitcoin as money, but we're asking for a broad definition that would pick up these electronic or cryptocurrencies. But we think this is a policy choice. We could choose to define money by rule, but we think it's more important that we turn this over to this body and have that decision come from the legislature. Anyway, we think it's important because we're seeing more and more companies that are engaged in this electronic use of electronic monies or cryptocurrencies wanting to get licensed as money transmitters. And, of course, we're having a problem with it. The traditional definition of money is such that they wouldn't fall within that. But we think there is some benefit to having some recourse for consumers if something goes awry, just like there is when they're actually shipping money through U.S. dollars through a money transmitter, say Western Union. And I will say this is an issue that all the states are looking at. If you're familiar with the state of New York's actions, they have incorporated through their rulemaking an entire licensing process that really goes to great lengths to try and dictate how all this works. We think that's a little premature. Let's see how long this is, if this has legs or not. So we come before you today asking twofold from this bill. One, authority to revamp the licensing process for three categories, and then two, to consider how we should define money. I'm happy to answer any questions or take any comments that you may have.
Okay. Questions?
So I'm not sure why you mentioned it in relation to this bill, but you mentioned you're redoing your IT system because it's 10 years old. Of course, you don't redo a computer system because it's 10 years old.
Correct.
So I'm assuming that it's not doing the job.
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, that's correct. I misspoke. It's not based on age. In fact, it was a system that was designed over 10 years ago, and it's no longer supported. It's no longer supported by our agency, and in fact, we can't get upgrades or anything else like that. It's an outdated system, and we would have to replace it regardless, but this system already exists in it. And I failed to mention, if you excuse me, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB, the product of the Dodd-Frank Act, is also charged with licensing certain areas, and they are taking a look at this and, in fact, have spoken approvingly of using this national system as well. So I really think it's where we're all headed, and we're just trying to stay current with that before we invest money in a system that we'd only be using for a couple more years.
Another question. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're talking about the bits, cyber money,
mm-hmm.
And how does that fit in? How do you propose to use that in your department?
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, what we're proposing right now is it's in the definition of within the money transmitter section. So we would be using it solely if people are transmitting these bitcoins or other electronic currencies between two parties. Right now we're seeing some people that are just engaged in money exchange. So just like when you go to the airport and you want to convert to pesos, and you go in and you exchange dollars for pesos or vice versa, that's not transmitting. It's a transaction right there. You're getting what you bargained for because you're right there getting it. But we are seeing more and more people wanting to send money between two parties. And it's that transmission piece that we're concerned about because we want to make sure the person doing the transmitting is trustworthy, bonded, reliable, and so forth. And until we have that definition of money to include this electronic currencies, there's a real question in our mind whether we have the authority to address the transmission of electronic currency or cryptocurrencies, as we're calling them, between two private parties.
Follow up?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get my head around why you want to even deal with this transmission of money between two parties, one of which is not you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, we are already charged with that responsibility. We regulate money transmitters.
So okay.
Western Union and a whole host of others who engage in transmitting money on behalf of Party A to Party B, whether it's in the state or okay. within the United States or all the way down to the Philippines or Mexico. We regulate that. We see this as the same thing. Consumers don't have any recourse if they're dealing with somebody who hasn't got any kind of background established or anything else. It's a Wild West situation otherwise.
Has any government acknowledged or has control of cyber money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, the money, no. No government has put their stamp of approval on the money. But if it's going to be deemed money and people are using it in a currency-like situation, then people are going to want to know that when they give the money to the XYZ Corporation, or let me rephrase that, when they give the Bitcoin to the XYZ Corporation to transmit to their family member in Florida, that that money will get there. And if it doesn't, they have some recourse for the failure to deliver.
So basically, somebody buys Bitcoins in one place, transmits them via this other corporation, which does the transmission, and at the other end, they trade it for money, for government-issued money.
No, not necessarily.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, that may be the case. It may not be the case. That the at the back end, they may be receiving the Bitcoins just as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we're saying that we see this becoming a situation where it is just a direct substitute for fiat government-issued or government-backed currency. It's one and the same now, except that there's no government value behind it.
Thank you.
Senator Girard?
Thank you. If you watch TV, we all know about all the hackers. My question about DCBS, where are you storing your data?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, where are we storing our data? In the data center that's, I believe, backed up in Eastern Oregon.
Well, I hate to say it, but I really don't think that's a safe place. From everything that I learned in Las Vegas when I did a technology course down there, is that we should be using multinational companies to store our data because it's just so easy to breach. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, thank you for that. I know people are listening back home in the department, and we'll take that under consideration.
I think, Senator, that's probably a DAS question rather than DCBS question.
Well, but DCBS, especially if they're going to do Cover Oregon, they're going to have a tremendous amount of information. And, a HIPAA violation and the social insurance numbers that come with that, if I am negligent with my charts, fines could go up to $1 million. So, and I would assume that the state's equally as liable. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, that's absolutely correct. In fact, we are charged with responsibility at DCBS with overseeing data breaches, and we certainly see as many data breaches from different levels of government as we do from the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Not sure how it directly relates to this one, but okay.
Thank you, Chair. I just noticed your bill has an emergency clause at the end of it. I see that a lot on bills lately. Yeah. What's the reason you have an emergency clause in this bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, I believe what we wanted to be able to do was start the implementation process because we have a renewal system that will kick in at the end of the year. And so we don't want to be out there trying to do the necessary rulemaking in late fall when people are already trying to figure out what they need to do to get properly in line with our requirements. For instance, we had a conversation with our bankers just the other day. We were talking about bank fees, and we wanted to talk to them about it in December, and we did, and they were complaining that that didn't give them enough time to work through the process, even though the bank fees were due in March. So we've just found with government, particularly with rulemaking, we have to build in at least 120 days to go through the processes.
Just for clarification, if there isn't an emergency clause, it would not go into effect until January of 2016.
Yeah, it's probably one of the first real reasons I've seen to have an emergency clause on a bill this session, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Follow up? You're done. Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you,
that's
Mr.
all
Chair.
I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 277? So we will close the public hearing on 277 and open a work session, and the chair moves Senate Bill 277 to the floor with a do pass. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, Senate Bill 277 is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation, and the knowledgeable Senator Girard will carry. We'll close on that. And and I see I'm going to open a public hearing on 278. James, I think we heard this once before.
Am I wrong on that?
No.
We haven't heard that. Okay, we'll do it then.
It's been on the agenda for 2 weeks.
Maybe that's why I thought it was. That and Mr. Crosgrove's notes that he hasn't had a chance to testify on it yet.
Senate Bill 278 voids loans of $50,000 or less issued by unlicensed lenders to Oregon consumers, prohibits unlicensed lenders, collections agencies, and financial institutions from collecting on unlicensed loans, allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to account for persons who made loans while holding a lapsed license, declares emergency effective on passage, becomes operative 91 days after effective date of measure. There is an amendment to this bill, -1, clarifies that if license lapse, the loan is voidable but not voided. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact on the -1 amendment.
Well, I should have just let you stay here, huh?
Yeah, bring up Mr. Blackwell again.
Yeah.
So new bill, new record. I will go through the same startup. For the record, David Tapman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. With me is Richard Blackwell, our Senior Policy Analyst for the Division. And we're here today to discuss Senate Bill 278. Again, a fairly narrow read. I want to give the committee a little bit of background, and then we can talk a little bit about the proposed amendment from Mr. Cosgrove, or we can wait till he introduces it, and then we can come back and discuss it at your pleasure. The issue behind that we want to address today is again another policy issue, and it's one that we think that we want to raise before this committee and before the legislature, and that is the question in legal terms of whether an illegal contract should be deemed void, and that is it doesn't exist from the outset, or whether it should be treated as voidable, meaning it still is a contract but may have some limitations or restrictions. Now, that's a legal description, and I know that's kind of off-putting, but the reality is what we're looking at is we think is a self-help protection for consumers who have been subject to predatory lending practices from people who have not bothered to comply with our laws, and particularly without getting a license. As I mentioned, we license consumer finance lenders. We also license payday lenders and title lenders. Those are three different categories of smaller face value loans than what banks and credit unions typically make, but not always. But consumer finance lenders typically are making household or personal loans for over 60 days. Usually they're amortized, so you're making periodic payments, typically monthly payments. And the amount of loan is going to be under $50,000. Since 1999, we've also regulated payday lenders and title lenders, and a payday loan is in most instances one that is less than 60 days. There's no underwriting. That is, there's no determination of the ability of the person to repay the loan for a payday loan. And typically there's a single repayment at the end of that period of time. The loan is secured or provides for either a post-dated check that they will collect from at the end of that period of time, or more and more we're seeing ACH, electronic withdrawals from bank accounts. That's the preferred method. Title lending is very similar, but in addition to or in lieu of someone having a stream of income or a basis for repayment, they may take security of the car title itself to secure the loan, but again, they're short-term and small-face dollar amounts. Since 2007, we have the legislature passed and said that these loans should be deemed voidable. Voided in that they can't collect on these loans if the loans are being made by somebody who is unlicensed. However, in 2007, there were three criteria put in that would allow for continued collection. One, that the loan substantially met the terms of the law. In other words, they hit that 36% mark or less, and that the loan conditions met the requirements that the law requires. Two, that the person conveyed to us that they didn't know they should be licensed or that they were required to be licensed. And three, they obtained a license. So, in other words, they could collect on that loan should they ultimately get a license after the fact. In addition, things became a little more problematic in 2010 when there was a decision made, again, by the legislature to divide consumer finance lending from the other kinds of lending. So we ended up with Chapter 725 in the ORS that provides for consumer finance lending and 725A that provides for payday and title lending. The problem was that language that I just described that allowed for unlicensed people to collect only if they went after the fact and got licensed doesn't exist in Chapter 725. So right now, if somebody engages in consumer finance lending and they're unlicensed, there's no limitation on their ability to collect. We think that's a gross injustice. And you may say, so, you know, you've got your consumer finance companies and they're licensed and they're not violating the law. That is correct. But we're finding, though, is more and more people that we would call payday lenders are engaged in what you the statute would say is consumer finance lenders. And so we would create a situation where they could engage in this illegal conduct, not be licensed, and still be able to collect on the loans. Now, why is this such a problem? It's a huge problem because through the internet, we're seeing more and more lenders available to consumers who are looking to obtain loans. And these consumers are just through the internet clicking on and agreeing to these loans. They will fill out a loan application. On that application, they'll identify where their bank is. They'll authorize an ACH withdrawal of their monies. And then we will see companies proceed to withdraw money with a fair degree of consistency and rapidity, taking money out periodically above and beyond what they agreed to do. And there's really no recourse for the consumer at that point except to close the bank account. Well, as you can imagine, closing your one bank account, particularly if you're somebody that needs this type of loan, is problematic. And should they also have other monies coming out of that account, like many of us do for car loans and the like, that becomes a problem because then the recipient of those fees is going to stop and they're going to have to recreate that. So we're seeing that the internet is being used as an exploitive tool. Just one example. We had a case from a lending company on the island of Malta, and we're seeing lenders from Malta and Nevis all over the Caribbean engage in a lot of this activity. 4 years ago, we got a complaint from four consumers that they had taken out loans from this company, and the loans were illegal under Oregon law, that they charged an interest well in excess of this 36%, and in fact were in excess of 400% per annum. We took action. We issued a cease and desist order. We fined them and did all the things that we're authorized to do. 2 years later, the same company comes back and engages in this conduct again. There's just a limitation to what the agency can do to stop this behavior, especially when they're offshore. We've done a lot around consumer education. I don't know if you remember, but last Christmas time, when people were in the mood for needing money to shop, we had a full-blown campaign throughout Oregon identifying that the risks of borrowing money from people who aren't licensed. We always ask people to please check to see if they're licensed beforehand. That doesn't always result the result we want. So the outcome is, under this law, that we think, although we think our payday lenders and our consumer finance lenders are doing a fine job and they're meeting the needs of the consumers overall, at 11 o'clock at night, they may not be available when somebody decides they've got to borrow money, and so they turn to the internet. We think it's important that we provide this consumer protection tool so that consumers can go to their banks and say, this ACH I entered into is the subject of an illegal contract, and the contract should be declared void, and you don't have to continue to honor the ACH and allow these payments to go to these illegal companies. I'm not sure if there's anything else I need to touch on. Yes, as I mentioned, Mr. Cosgrove has a proposal to allow for inadvertent failure to, if I understand, and he can explain this better than I can, but if there's an inadvertent failure to renew your license as a consumer finance lender, that inadvertent license lapse should not prevent them from being able to collect. And we touched on that. That's one of the criteria. But under there's a unique provision under the consumer finance law that essentially says a consumer finance license continues indefinitely until the affirmative step by the state agency to revoke the license or until a person submits to us a notification that they're tendering the turn-in of their license. It continues in perpetuity until such time. Now, if you don't pay your fees, we may move to revoke the license. But until that happens, you are authorized to engage in this conduct, assuming it's legal conduct that is meeting the criteria. So we don't think there's a need for this because the legislature's already provided for coverage under this. So with that, if I haven't made too much of a muddied the waters too much, I'm happy to try and answer any questions.
So, just thinking about this, this seems like it's a provision that's very similar to what you have with credit card agencies in terms of if you think a charge is inappropriate, you can stop the collection on it.
Mr. Chair, that's right, although the discretion ultimately lies with the credit card company. They have to investigate, and if they determine they think it is valid, you may be
I guess that's a third-party thing.
But it's similar in that, yes, this gives them some avenue. The reality is, most of the time, these ACHs are done with unbeknownst to the party until they happen to look at their bank account or until they try and write a check and they realize there's nothing in the account because it's been cleared out. The problem is that we have seen and many times seen where people are actually drawing more than what they've contracted for, even though the contract calls for exorbitant interest rates. They'll charge additional fees and additional basis of taking money out, and the bank has no way of knowing because the bank's not privy to the contract. They just know this ACH was authorized by the account holder.
Senator Dredd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I got, again, this seems like kind of a BB gun bazooka sort of thing. And when I say that, say, for example, you have a lender that's in compliance with Oregon law, except he's not licensed. Under this scenario, he would void all his loans. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dredd, yes, that would be the case. I have not ever encountered that case.
Well, but I mean, that sort of thing is going to happen, and you're excusing somebody that's borrowed $50,000 or up to $50,000 that they don't have to pay back the loan. I just think that this really needs to be amended. I understand that there's fraud in the arena, but for God's sakes, I mean, I just go out and start taking out loans and going through and trying to make sure that I could prove that that they're in noncompliance, and then I get free money.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dredd, your point I understand, and you could have somebody that manipulative. We've seen the imbalance goes the other way, and we've seen nobody. Most of these loans are for less than $5,000.
But even the Malta example that you gave, say that they're in compliance with Oregon law and everything within, you know, the interest rates and everything, they're not going to have a Oregon license to do business here, so they would be in noncompliance.
Is that a may or a shall, though?
It would be a shall.
It is a shall. Okay.
So in answer to the Malta situation, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Dredd, typically the situation is if something comes to our attention, we write and say, get licensed. And
yeah, but they have to forfeit all their loans. I just think that this is really extreme. And I understand trying to protect the public from loan sharks, and I'm all for it. But this is going so far over the top that it's just
okay.
Really hard for me to understand.
If I can make just one more point, and it may not make that big a difference, but this is a private right of action. So this is individual to individual. It won't be something where the state of Oregon is coming in and saying, as the parents, you know, the state coming in and saying, we're taking action against you, and all these have to be unwound. This is Joe Citizen going to his or her bank and saying, wow, they've taken out $5,000. They continue to take this money out. This is an illegal loan. They don't put the money back in. It just stops it at that bleeding at that point.
One last comment, and this is it, but at least it's my understanding under current law, if they're in noncompliance, never mind. I'm gonna shut up when it's better to shut up.
Senator Thompson.
I was thinking along the same lines as Senator Dredd. So if I borrow $300 and they start taken money out, and it's up to $250 that I have left or whatever, and I find out they don't have a license, do I have to pay them that extra $50 or is my loan done?
Senator,
that's what this sounds like, that I could go out and get a $10,000 loan and figure out this guy's unlicensed and put the $10,000 in my apartment. You shut him down, and I've just made $10,000. So if I take out the $500 loan and I still have a balance and we find out they're unlicensed, am I still responsible to pay that loan back, or am I off scot-free?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, the latter. But the situation, again, is not $10,000, $20,000. Situation is you have to affirmatively go forward to your bank, or if somebody's trying to collect this loan through a collection effort, say at the courthouse, then you can affirmatively raise this. So you would not be obligated to pay that back. But they're not waiting for you to pay them. They've set it up so that they're getting paid directly. This isn't where you can affirmatively decide not to write a check. They're taking that money out every month through the ACH, or they're holding one of your checks, typically not that much anymore, but they're holding one of your checks as collateral for the repayment. So we liken this to the same thing with any other illegal loan. This is an illegal loan. The circumstances are such, it doesn't come to our attention unless, and again, it doesn't have to come to our attention, but they don't come to our attention unless we're seeing people that are charging outrageous interest rates and collecting much more than what they're allowed to under Oregon law. I know it's hard to imagine that some of these companies, we want to assume the best, and we do, but there are a lot of companies that are just taking full advantage of this. It's not that different from somebody who's engaged in loan sharking.
So do you guys get involved? Does your agency get involved with this, or does the bank have to? Because who's responsible for deciding if this person is unlicensed lender and all that stuff? Is that the bank's responsibility, or do you guys cover all that, your agency?
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, as we said, this would be a self-help situation where the consumer would bring it to the attention of the bank. We've got all our licensees listed on our website. They could easily verify that they're unlicensed. My assumption would be the consumer would first go and determine they're not licensed. Well, hopefully they'd do it before they ever took the loan out, but assuming they didn't, they go and find out that they're unlicensed, then they go to the bank and say, this is an illegal loan, and the bank would check with us.
One last follow-up. So, I mean, this seems to me like this decision will, it's a pretty good idea if you want to stop what you're doing, because if I go out and get a $500 loan from one of these people, you know, I just want the money. I need the money for tomorrow for buy something, or my wife's going to kill me or something like that. So I go out and find one of these licensees, and then the next day I go to the bank and stop because I knew when I took this loan out the person was unlicensed. So this just seems like a, like Senator Drudge said, this is like a last-ditch, heavy-handed effort. I would think you would eliminate all those people with this law. I would assume that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, that's the goal, is to eliminate the illegal conduct. Over the last 4 years, we have gotten in excess of 50 complaints. As I said, we put together a campaign because we're getting so many complaints. We've taken 20 administrative actions. It's a fruitless effort to take administrative actions against companies that are outside the United States. They don't look at us. We could even get a judgment and we can't collect it. So the reality is we're doing just what you said. We're trying to say, you want to do this, here's the avenue to do it. It's no different than someone that's engaged in illegal bank lending or something like that. We would expect the bank to get chartered with us.
Do you have a list of those people I could get from you right after this meeting?
A list of the licensed ones?
Unlicensed.
We don't keep a list of the unlicensed.
Oh, rats.
They'll just change their names, Senator.
Okay.
they would probably have your bank account emptied before you could stop it. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two or three questions. One is, having worked at the bank, and isn't it possible already for a person with a bank account to put a stop pay on ACH just like they do on a check?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, yes, they could do that. But I haven't seen that they've always been successful in getting the bank to do that.
So this is going to be a directive to the bank?
I believe so.
Okay. And there were some other issues, one of them being I was here when we did payday loans, and obviously the goal of that was to get people to, you know, people were charging $400, $800, 800% to stop doing that and not do usury loans. And of course, all those people went to some other place and opened it up on the internet, or at least somebody did. Maybe not those people. I would think that, first of all, unlike Senator Rod, I like this bill because I believe that it does protect to some degree folks. But the problem is that they won't, as you point out, they won't even know it in time, usually, to do anything about those funds that are taken out over and above the loan. And is there anything, I guess there's nothing we can do about that because they're offshore. Do we have a possible fix for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, boy, don't I wish. We've talked with the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. They are charged directly by Congress with oversight of payday lending. They don't have a good handle on this offshore activity.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate to characterize this as a blowing a fan against a hurricane, but that's really what we're trying to do, is give people some self-help, because I don't think regulators have gotten their arms around this.
Right.
My hope is the economy will ultimately improve sufficiently. What we do is stress our efforts around education and remind people that we have roughly 35, 40 payday lenders in the state and well over 70 consumer finance lenders.
Who are doing it legally.
Doing it legally, and we encourage people, if that's what they need to do, to go use them. They're,
mm-hmm.
they're bricks and mortar. They're in the state. And there are actually two online that are licensed. So it's not like because you're online, you can't get a license. It just means most of these people aren't engaged or are not interested in getting a license. They're just seeing this as the fraud du jour. And the other point I didn't make, and I apologize for this, is we're not the first state proposing this. There's 13 to 14 states doing this. And in talking with the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, they've taken action against certain companies based on violations or complaints by citizens, and we talked to them about taking some of Oregon's on, and they won't do it because it's voidable versus this void notion. They'll only take on the void cases.
Yeah. One more, if I may. It seems to me that if I avoid paying a loan, a legal loan, then the lender has recourse through the courts.
Absolutely. You're right.
And so if I stop paying on a loan that is a legal loan, even though the person's not licensed, the court may, in fact, fine for the lender and make you pay it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, that's right. If you don't fall into these categories of meeting the definition, so it's a private loan between you and somebody else, you don't pay, you're still obligated under the conditions of that note.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. We're happy to stick around and answer any questions if Mr. Cosgrove should be raised up during his testimony.
Okay. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing Oregon Financial Services Association. We're the nearly 80-year-old trade association for licensed consumer finance companies. And I use that 80-year-old trade association to reflect that some of our members have been operating in the state for even longer than that before they had need of a trade association. So we've been around for a very long time. Some of our members do have some internet business, but they also have brick-and-mortar locations in places from Portland to Eugene to Baker City. We are the proponents of the Dash One because we're concerned about the issue of voiding loans when somebody has had a license and the license lapses for whatever reason. And I think that's not what the thrust of Mr. Tatman's desire to attack is. Another issue that frankly came up when Mr. Tatman was testifying is the issue of, he says that there are some people who may not know they need a license, they're making perfectly fine loans, but they're not, don't know they have a license. That, I think, is also an issue that should not be given this heavy hammer. But the one thing I would mention to you is, I think he's incorrect in response to his answer to you, Senator Riley. The difference between void and voidable is just exactly that. If a loan is voidable, a bank could either, a court could either enforce it or not enforce it based on the circumstances. If it's void, that means the lender would lose, even though it was otherwise a reasonable loan if the person was unlicensed. And that is our concern. We think this issue should remain voidable, which is the may, rather than void, which is the shall. And current law right now is it's voidable in circumstances where somebody's making a very bad and loan that's particularly harmless and they don't harmful and they don't have a license, a court could void it, and that's appropriate, but it doesn't have to void it, and that's what this bill changes. It makes it automatically void, even in those circumstances that I think we would all agree probably don't make sense. So that's our concern. I'm not sure that the Dash One actually fixes the second problem that Mr. Tatman raised. It was addressed to the first problem of the lapsed license. I'd be willing to work with Mr. Brackwell, who brought these issues to us in a conversation yesterday, I think it was, if my memory serves, to see if the Dash One is the correct way to solve the problem of not voiding loans that we think shouldn't, in fact, be voided, but just be voidable at the discretion of a court. Happy to answer any questions.
Well, it strikes me that I think Mr. Chapman's, what he's trying to get at is indeed something we ought to get at. Do think that people, that lenders ought to have an avenue to come to the court on legitimately collect things. I suspect that the Malta case or whatever, they would probably never show up.
No,
they would have the option of doing that, and people ought to be able to stop the withdrawals until that was challenged. So I'll tell you what I'd like to do, and I'll see if anybody wants to testify. I'd like to put this one over for maybe a week or so and see if you can get together and come up with some language that you're both comfortable with, if that makes sense. Would you be willing to work on that one?
Of course, Mr. Chair. Happy to do so.
Senator Riley?
Yes, before he goes away. Would it work for you if the language, instead of substituting voidable for void, if it said for lapsed licenses, it's voidable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, the Dash One actually does that. It says that if the loan was made at a time where there had been a lapse in the license, it's no longer the discretion of the department director. It becomes voidable, and it's at the discretion of the court. It doesn't have all those words in it, but that is the legal effect. What it doesn't address is the issue that Mr. Tatman just raised, which is somebody who didn't know they needed a license. We have lots of technical licensing statutes, makes a perfectly fine loan. The department comes to them, and then they get a license. You know, that may be something else that is not appropriate to make it automatically and absolutely void. So the Dash One does not address that second issue.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Now, I think where I would like to end up, I think with others, is that I think you need the presumption, particularly for those offshores, that it is void unless challenged and overruled by a court.
Mr. Chair, yes, our members aren't in Malta.
Which I don't think, frankly, I don't think is going to probably cause any trouble for your members.
Yeah. Your members all have licenses, I assume.
It's a condition of their membership that they have licenses, although as licenses sometimes lapse. They may not lapse automatically, as Mr. Tatman mentioned, but that's
But they
the
didn't
situation.
Forget to get them.
Pardon?
They didn't forget to get them.
No, they usually send in their check on an annual basis like we all do, but, you know. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Anybody else wish to testify on this? Hearing none, we will close the public hearing on 278, and we'll bring that one back in a week or so. Yeah, probably a couple of weeks. All righty. So we have some people from out of town that wanted to deal with. Which one was it, James?
Yeah, 138.
138. So I'm going to move that up, make sure we get to that so they don't have to come back again. I think the S is people around here all the time. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 138. James.
Senate Bill 138 removes the production limit of 5,000 barrels per year for brewery public house licenses selling malt beverages who self-distribute their product. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendments.
And do I have a sheet? Mm-hmm. I have a sheet. Oh, let's see here. Well, we'll just go down a list. Art Lawrence? Yeah, sure. Matt, anybody else who are with you? Are you?
Yes, Senator, we have Jeff Dentz is back there as well.
Well, why don't you come on up, too? Whoever wants to go first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing Cascade Brewing in support of Senate Bill 138. I'll just be very brief before these gentlemen here testify and give you all of the information, but we are in full support of the bill as drafted, but I just want you to know that we are talking with the opponents of this, the distributors, to see if there is some kind of compromise that we can work out as far as the number of barrels to be produced for self-distribution. This bill, as drafted, takes that limit completely off, and we're looking at a variety of different options that we're talking about with the distributors as possible solutions. With that, I'll let Art and others talk.
Senator Beyer, Chairman, and members of the committee, my name is Art Lawrence. I own Cascade Brewing Company, Raccoon Lodge and Brew Pub, and Cascade Brewing Barrel House in Portland. 30 years ago, I was in this room with a group of seven of us to introduce the brewpub legislation. I'm one of the seven fathers of the brewpub legislation. Those people were the McMiniman brothers, the Widmer brothers, Dick Ponzi that did Bridgeport Brewing, and Fred Bowman and I from Hillsboro that did Portland Brewing. And we all got together because we wanted to try to brew beer and sell it on our own premise. And at that time, it wasn't legal. Go back to the days when we had Weinhardt's in Portland, and many of us got to go to Weinhardt's tasting room and drink free beer. And the reason was because post-prohibition brought out laws that said the breweries were tied houses. They didn't want to have a lot of brewery-owned retail establishments. Weinhardt's owned four of them in Portland prior to prohibition, but after prohibition, they owned none. So breweries were prohibited from selling beer on their own premise. So when we came here in 1985, we wanted to go and add the brewery public house part to the brewery part. And let me kind of use my hands to tell the story. This is brewery. This is public house. Brewery could go and do its own distribution, but they couldn't sell any beer on premise. Kurt and Rob Widmer wanted to have a brewery, do their own distribution, and have a small pub. So there's a limitation put on the brewery, 10,000 barrels. I was over here with Portland Brewing, Fred and I. We didn't want to do any distribution at that time. We wanted to have a brew pub, sell on our premise, and get a temporary sales license to get to do public events. The brewery bumped it up. Widmer's bumped up to 10,000 barrels. They went to 25,000. The brew pubs were at zero distribution. They went to 500. The breweries went to 50,000. The brew pubs went to 1,000. The 50,000 limit went to 250,000 for breweries, and went to 5,000 for brew pubs. Breweries went to unlimited, where they are right now, and brew pubs are set here at 5,000. I'm seeking equality. I want to have the same privilege that the big boys do. I want to allow my family business, my daughter is here with me, I want to allow my family business to grow and not be regulated by politics of the distributors. I don't want them to limit what I can do and what I can expand. I want to expand my business. I don't want an out-of-state owned distributorship and a distributorship owned by the largest brewery in the world that also owns distributorships dictate me what I can do in my own dying state where I've lived. Our family has been in here for over 100 years. I don't want to get trampled on by the big boys. I want to be able to grow at my own pace and not be dictated by politics on how much money I can spend, how many people I can hire, and what I can benefit the state for. I see this as
as a chance for our craft brewing to grow. I'm 71 years old. This month, I want to leave something here for the guy behind me. I'm just fine in my own business, but I'm worried about those 10, 15, and 20 years ago. Having sat in this room 30 years ago, we had no idea on what impact that we would have on the world. We're just not going to talk about Oregon, but the state, but we're talking about a worldwide impact that Oregon has done in craft brewing. And you can see the business grow. I want to be able to grow, and not be dictated by people that take their money out of state. This is the only industry that has the people that we sell to oppose us. It's very unique. And I'm looking for your support so that I can continue to have my family grow our business and let the rest of the craft brewers in Oregon grow. We've got over 200 of them right now, and it's highly competitive, and we need every opportunity we can to succeed. And this is one of the opportunities, and I think it's unjustly putting a lid on business, and I can see no wide reason, the whole wide world, why any of you would say, Art, I'm sorry, you can't go hire any more people. You can't give our state any more money. We're sorry. We've got enough money. Take your money and go to Washington. And I don't think that's the message that you want to give. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Dentz. I am a professor of political science at Eastern Oregon University. My research focuses on craft beer policy, especially its impact on economic development, tourism, and public finance. The 21.7% increase in year-to-date production from November 2013 to November 2014 and a parallel increase in Oregon's privilege taxes are a clear indicator of the positive fiscal impact by the craft beer industry. Senate Bill 138 deals with two related policy issues: production caps for breweries and the ability of breweries to stealth distribute their product. An evaluation of these two policy issues in other states reveals 21 states have no production cap for breweries similarly situated as Cascade Barrel House. Note the nomenclature from state to state is different. No other state uses the brewery public house terminology that's used in Oregon. 39 states allow breweries to self-distribute. Of these 39 states, only 8 states, including Oregon, impose a production cap limit on the right to self-distribute. Only Michigan at 1,000 barrels and Arizona at 3,000 barrels have smaller production caps on the right to self-distribute than Oregon. With Oregon excluded from this group of 8 states, the average production cap for breweries able to self-distribute is 21,286 barrels, more than 4 times the current limit imposed in Oregon. By removing the production cap for breweries to self-distribute, it will invariably lead to increases in production, additional job creation, and privilege taxes paid to the state. Senate Bill 138 enhances the chances for long-term success for the craft beer industry while providing much-needed revenue to government coffers. Passage of this bill will prove to be a win-win change in craft beer policy that benefits both the craft beer industry and public finance in Oregon. Thank you for your time, and be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Professor, you've obviously researched this a lot. My guess is that at least the brewers that I'm familiar with, when they get to a certain size, they seem to hang on to our contract with the distributor anyway, don't they?
Thank you for your question, Chair Beyer. Contracts between the breweries and the distributors are on a case-by-case basis. Oftentimes, it's basically a marriage for life. And getting out of one of those contracts is extremely difficult. We don't see a lot of movement in the industry from distributor to distributor by a particular craft brewery.
Seen one recently. rather public one, yeah.
Yes.
Other questions?
One very quick.
Senator Riley.
Where do you get a job researching craft beer?
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, thank you for your inquiry. I guess my proper title is Professor of Political Science and Craft Beer Studies. Before that, my primary research, which I appeared many times over here in the state capitol, was on state gambling policy. So evidently I have vice in my blood.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Mr. Romain, it's been a while. First time this year.
In this committee. I've been busy other places. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland with my daughter at the Romain Group, and we represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And what we're really trying to do is figure out what problem we're trying to solve, because I think we can solve whatever problem exists. A couple of things. First, a little history. I may diverge a little bit. Oregon is considered the model for craft brewing and distribution around the country, literally. When we go to national meetings, people are always sort of questioning why the state allows brewers and brew pubs to do so much. And we say it's because it's good for the state. And frankly, as you put it, there's a certain point where they get up to a certain amount and they really don't distribute themselves. But they should have a right to self-distribute within the state. There is a huge difference between a brew pub and a brewery. And that was what was recognized in 85 when we passed this law in the first place. Originally, we had in Oregon what was called a two-tier system. Most states, or a lot of states, had three-tier, where you had, if you owned a manufacturer, you couldn't have an interest in a wholesaler, and if you owned a wholesaler or a manufacturer, you couldn't have an interest in a retailer. We had a two-tier system where we allowed brewers to be wholesalers and wholesalers to be brewers, but none could own any interest in a retail establishment. So what we tried to do with the legislation, the early legislation, was to say, all right, you can do, you pick the two tiers you want to be in. You can be in brewing and restaurant, or you be in brewing and distribution, but you can't be in all three. That's kind of gotten a little muddled over the years. But as we have approached this over the years with brewpub self-distribution, we kept raising the limit a little bit, because everybody should have a right to get their product to market. And we just feel that's very important. When we crafted the current statute, where we put in a production limit, we basically said you couldn't produce more than 5,000 barrels. That was because our assumption at that time was that every brewpub was only distributing within the state of Oregon. So really what would probably work out, and which we're talking to Mr. Marquis about, is if you change that to distribution rather than production. The state doesn't track production. You could produce 100,000 barrels, state wouldn't know about it. They only know what you sell in the state. And frankly, we don't care what you sell in another state. Nobody does. So one of the things you could probably do, and one of the things that we think we'll talk about, is actually changing that production threshold to a distribution threshold, because that really takes into account every brew pub. Art Lawrence's brewery or brew pub, I think last year distributed or sold in the state, at least the tax sale, were a little over 1,000 barrels. They're not even close to the 5,000. But again, if they want to be able to self-distribute, they should be able to do that, and we're fine with it. What we don't want to do, and this is the problem, is we don't really like to have multinational companies come in and kind of take over the whole everything out there. And that's what Tide House is all about. So we're trying to craft something that takes into account that, yet allows Mr. Lawrence to distribute what he wants to distribute. As far as franchise is concerned, our franchise law, frankly, is considered one of the models around the country. There are states where it is a contract for life, which we think is obscene. And we've stated that at national organizations, where basically once you enter into a contract, you can never get out. Ours basically says, if you want to switch from one distributor to another or take it back yourself, it's like a sale. All you have to do is negotiate a sale of the product. So it allows everybody to get out whenever they want to get out. It just provides fair value. That's all it does. But again, there is, my understanding is there's one entity, and I say one entity, but it's a conglomerate, it's McMenamin's, that has a brewery, one of their brew pubs is actually producing more than 5,000 or wants to distribute more than 5,000, but we haven't heard the particulars of it, but we want to reach out to them and find out what the problem is. So as soon as we define what the problem is, we can probably come back to you with a much better and more narrowly focused solution to that problem. But right now, Mr. Lawrence can distribute every drop that he produces under the current law. And for unless he's got really ambitious plans, which I'm sure he does because I've known Art for most of my life here, probably does. And who knows? It might come true, and we want to help him get to that point. Okay. So we'll come back to you if you hold this over a little bit. We'll come back to you. We're meeting with Marquis and the rest.
Questions? No questions. Thank you very much, Paul. Anybody else wish to testify on this? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 138, and we will hold it over for a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
All right. Now we got some accountant stuff here. Let's see.
You wouldn't want to hold over another bill you have there.
What?
You wouldn't want to hold over another bill you have in the Senate.
We'll do.
There's quite a few of them.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 272. James?
Chair, Senate Bill 272 modifies general powers of Oregon Board of Accountancy and provisions regulating accountants reflecting best practice in state statutes and the Uniform Accountancy Act. Updates definition of attest services to restrict non-certified public accountant, CPA, providers engaging in representation work in the use of language and representation that suggests training in and accountability to a CPA profession standard, establishes Oregon Board of Accountancy Fund and State Treasury and continuously appropriates money and funds to the Board for administration and enforcement of laws regulating accountants, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact and there is a minimal fiscal impact and no amendments.
Thank you. I have three people signed up for this. Mr. McConnell, looks like Mr. Wright, and Mr. Pictoni? Pictoni? Probably did that terrible, and I apologize for that. Whomever wants to go first.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the executive director for the Board of Accountancy, I'm very pleased to be here today to provide testimony about Board Proposed Senate Bill 272. You have in the record, both coming to you as well as online, a copy of my written testimony. I'm not here to read it to you. I would just like to very briefly summarize a couple of highlights for you today. One is I simply wanted to provide this committee with an assurance on the record that the bill before you today is the outcome of a long process that started back in fall of 2013 that had all the board stakeholders at the table, and that includes representatives from OSCPA, including the gentleman to my right who will testify later, as well as representatives from the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. This bill is doing two things for us. One is a critically needed update to the definition of attest and report in our statutes, and that piece is really simply about reflecting nationally vetted language in the Uniform Accountancy Act, that's our model law, to address the evolution of the profession, and Scott Wright, who is to my right, will talk about that in more detail. I will focus on the other pieces that are really going on here. Beyond that definition, really what we try to do is accomplish two things with this bill. One is, for the first time in a long time, which you have to do once in a while, this board has been in operation for over 100 years, we wanted to take a comprehensive look at our statutes and rules and update them to the best practices, both reflected in the Uniform Accountancy Act, as well as the best practices that are there in the state of Oregon for regulatory boards. And I kind of want to take that opportunity to actually specifically thank on the record the Office of Legislative Counsel and Mark Meyer, who was really helpful with helping us get there on that piece. What the bill does not do is make comprehensive changes in terms of the powers of the board. So we're not really moving a lot of the goalposts here. This is mostly just an update on a better representation of the board's authority. There are a few exceptions to this that I've outlined in my testimony. One is the bill does provide us with much clearer authority than we had before to do rulemaking. Now, that's not a radical thing. Regulatory boards have rulemaking authority that is broad to implement their statutes. Ours was kind of is kind of helter-skelter in the current law. This one simply says you have it. The second piece that I wanted to briefly point out to you is the last big policy change that was made in the statutes for the Board of Accountancy was back in 2009 under Senate Bill 867, which allowed out-of-state licensees that are coming in from other boards of accountancy to come in under what is called practice privileges to do not all but quite a broad range of services without getting licensed through this board. This bill does not change that policy. What it does do is it levels the playing field and makes sure that the board has the same authority to hold that provider of services with an out-of-state license accountable for the services to Oregon consumers as we do somebody who has an Oregon license. And that's just simply just making sure that we have equal authority over, regardless of how you come in legally into the state to practice. Those are the two biggest highlights. There are other components here that I go into further detail in my written testimony, but I will prefer to, quite frankly, keep it short, open it up for questions if there are some, and allow Scott Wright to talk about really the core of the issue, which is the definition of a test update.
Mr. Wright. Chair Senator Beyer, Vice Chair Senator Girod, members of the committee, my name is Scott Wright. I am a CPA. I'm a member of partner of the CPA firm Curtis Stokes down in Eugene. I was recently reconfirmed to a second term of the Board of Accountancy, so I've been serving for a little over 3 years. As Mr. Petioni has pointed out, there a significant piece of this legislation deals with the changing of what we're using the term a test, and that is a term of trade that we use in public accounting. And to kind of bring it to what other than accountants will deal with, it's where the accountant's asked to certify, verify, confirm, provide some level of assurance on what something has been presented to them so that they could say, yes, we confirm this is correct, and a third party can rely on that information. And what the legislation does is to change Oregon law so that the definition of a test, those items I just mentioned, as described in the statute, agree with what national standards are now. There are organizations such as the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants that go through and develop, through the UAA process, help develop the language that all CPAs across the United States deal with, the professional standards. A test is something that has gone through some significant changes through the UAA. It's modified occasionally, in most cases in response to the fact that our profession is evolving. We as practitioners are being asked to provide more and more services that were not envisioned at the time some of these rules were drawn up, the professional standards were drawn up. Historically, a test has been applied strictly to financial statements. The accountant certifies or audits a financial statement that a bank can rely on, these numbers are correct. Our profession is evolving, and we're now being asked to verify other things such as sustainability and a variety of other things that were never even envisioned as at the time that the original standards were drafted. So this legislation changes Oregon law to bring Oregon in conformance, in essence, with standards that are being used throughout the United States. And as Mr. Pettione mentioned, it doesn't preclude anybody from services. It just simply says if you're going to, you can only use the language that indicates that it's subject to these national standards if you, in fact, are a CPA, a certified public accountant. Any questions?
Don't see any.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Stephen McConnell. I am representing the 4,700 members of the Oregon Society of CPAs, and as such, I'm a past chair of that organization and a past chair of the Board of Accountancy. Rather than go any further than what has already been laid out in front of you, I simply want you to know that we have worked, and as Martin indicated, I was one of the people on the task force for a significant period of time to craft and review the language in Senate Bill 272. We support the bill and urge you to pass it as requested by the board. The bill will enable the board to more effectively and efficiently regulate the CPA profession in its mission to protect the public. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? I just have one, and I don't know if you have you had a chance to talk with Mr. Hughes? He had a concern about the bill. And
Chair Beyer, we have not. I got wind about 1 minute before the committee hearing started. Okay. There may be an issue, and I'm certainly I've known this gentleman for a long period of time since the mid 80s, and I'm happy to work out whatever needs to be worked out and have a conversation. Okay. I don't know yet the substance very much.
Go ahead.
I have a quick question. As you know, I'm a dentist, and reciprocity is something that we're working on. Is the board working on reciprocity between, say, Idaho and Montana and Arizona, so that it just seems to me like there should be more interstate travel?
Actually, Chair Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, I have a little bit of a unique perspective on this because I was formerly an administrator of a health regulatory board, actually several different health regulatory boards, so I know a little bit about what's going on in your home licensure place and kind of how that compares. And actually, by comparison, when I walked into the Board of Accountancy, there is far more reciprocity and mobility in that profession than anything I've ever seen on the health board side. So they're, quite frankly, probably comparatively at least a decade ahead of the game where most of the health boards are, from my perspective.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Mr. Hughes, you didn't sign up. Do you need to sign up, or do you want to come up and talk?
Yes, I may.
You sure can.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ted Hughes, here today representing the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. That organization is made up of some CPAs, public accountants, tax preparers, tax consultants. So it's a conglomeration of most people that do taxes one way or the other belong to this trade association. We have some, as I said, a few CPAs and PAs. The public accountants are regulated by the State Board of Accountancy also. And they said to communicate to you that they did a wonderful job on this bill. I think the State Board should be commended, except I'm like the one-handed economist. On the other hand, on page 14, under the peer review section that they discussed a little while ago, they have done away with some language that a lot of my people in that association utilize. And the only reason that was given that I heard from the panel was that we want to make it uniform with everybody else in the United States, every other Board of Accountancy in the United States. And it's on line 22 where they eliminate a vehicle that lots of my public accountants use, the National Society of Accountants. They just take that language out of the bill. And I think it's more like want instead of need. And I see enough of that in the bills in this building that fit that category, want instead of need. And I do believe that that's why they took that out of there. And I'm sorry to hear that they included my people, a lot of my people apparently, in the task force that they formed a year and a half ago. I had no idea that that was going on, and I didn't hear from them. So I respectfully, I would love to just put that, I would have a great amendment for your legislative council to go in and just say, just leave that language the way it is. And legislative council would say, boy, you're a nice guy.
hang right there, Ted. Well, they're begging to come up and talk.
Oh, all right. We'll let him go. Will he be entertained?
Just hang tight. Let's see what he has to say.
Not as entertaining as Ted.
You stay there.
Yes, it's still there.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for pulling me back up here for a quick moment. I simply wanted to clarify one piece about the background here as I'm learning about what's going on. Because this process was a pretty warm and fuzzy process and very inviting, there is actually no dark cloud behind this language. The only reason this language is in there that deletes that reference that you have there on line 14 is because there's currently no peer review program that is operated by the NSA. So it basically, they used to have a peer review program. So when the statute was originally written, it made a lot of sense to have it in there as an additional reference. And the only reason it was taken out is because it doesn't exist anymore. And so I'm pretty sure that when we have a conversation with this very kind gentleman to my right, we can figure out a way forward.
All right. Is there anybody else who wanted to talk about this? Hearing none, I think we're going to hold this one over, too. You're not doing real well with my batting average of getting bills out today. But we will close on Senate Bill... Which one is this one? This 272, and we will hold that over as well. Thank you. we'll give you a week, Ted, to work on that. Is that okay?
Oh, yes, sir. That's plenty of time.
Cool. We'll see you in a week or so. We'll open very quickly then on, I think we can do this one, 254, and see if we can get this one done in a few minutes. I think it's simple. So don't surprise me.
I'll try not to.
SB 254, yes. Increase annual $5 assessment on all licensed motor fuel metering devices by 20% per year over the next 4 years, not to exceed a $10 assessment per device, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, no minimal fiscal asset, no amendments.
I'm not.
Please.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture, and I have with me Jason Barber, who leads our Weights and Measures program, as well as Steve Harrington, who's a program manager in that program. So if you have technical questions, they can help you. Before you is what should be a relatively simple fee bill. This fee supports our motor fuel quality inspection program, and this is where our agency has responsibility to make sure the octane is what's posted, to look for water in fuel, and then also respond to complaints about motor fuel when it's sold. So the program was put in place in the late 90s. The fee that was put in place at the time was $5. It's remained the same over many years. The costs have increased, and when the renewable fuel standards went into play in 2009 and were fully implemented in 2011, that increased the responsibility in this program and also increased the costs. The current costs today are about $300,000 biennium. Biennially, right? Annually. $300,000 annually to run the program. We collect about $155,000 $100,000. The program is being subsidized by our other fee payers in the Weights and Measures program for scales and other measuring devices. So given that background, I'll pause there and see if you have any additional questions.
Talk about
questions.
The implementation. You're talking about doubling the fee.
That's right.
Yes. Yep.
Talk about how it implements and how you got to those fee numbers, what participation you have.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. So we worked with many of our stakeholders to come up with a process to increase the fee to a maximum of $10 over the next 4 years. It's about a 20% increase annually. In year three, it goes up to $8 and I think 56 cents, so it rounds to the nearest dollar up to nine. And it'll move us over the next 4 years, starting in July of 2016, to a maximum of $10.
And you have agreement among the stakeholders?
Do you want to talk about your process, Jason?
You bet. Chair Beyer, Jason Barber, Department of Ag. Yeah, we've been working with the stakeholders listed in the testimony probably for the last 6 to 8 months. Paul was one of them with the Oregon Fuels, WISPA, Sequential, and the gentleman that Northwest Grocery Association for the grocery stores like Safeway and Fred Meyer that have stations as well. And no opposition, actually. Paul's group is very supportive of the move, and we're hoping to actually, in the email they sent, I was hoping we could do some additional compliance work over in Eastern Oregon and Southern Oregon. There's some concerns that diesel's coming into the state that is clean diesel and not following the B5 mandate.
I did mention to Lisa earlier today, we were talking, that I had had a conversation with the folks from Daimler. And one of their concerns is they said that, frankly, they said Oregon's standards were not as good as many other states, and it's causing problems for them in terms of warranty work on their diesels resulting from fuel. People, their customers are complaining about it, and this is really was the fuel, the quality of the fuel. They said our standards are not very good for enforcement, and they kept referencing me to, I think, Arkansas.
That's the biodiesel we're putting in.
That's all we have. You think the Arkansas biodiesel is better? Actually, they said it was inconsistent standards. Well, I don't know if it's the same thing.
Yeah, I guess my best response to that is, you know, we do have a very lean program. If you look on the second page, we did try to do some state cost analysis. I can tell you when Dr. Harrington and I go to our National Weights and Measures conference every year in July, that our federal partners and other state directors are kind of impressed, shocked, of what we're able to do with kind of a small amount of resources. I think based on what we're seeing, we've got 18 measures inspectors across the state. We leverage those folks, so when they're actually on-site testing the fuel meters, that is when they're also testing the fuel quality. And just briefly to run you through that, they're showing, I'll just use a retail station, they're coming in, they're doing a document review of all the bill of ladings to make sure that the B5 and E10 mandate is being met, as well as octane. A lot of the stations have kind of a monitoring tool with their underground storage units. They house in the garage portion, and they kind of print out kind of a history. They'll go review that as well. We're checking the in-ground fuel storage tanks, mainly for water. We do visual checks for sediment, color. The dipping stick that we have for the tanks have a ruler on the end. We put Sargel, a compound on that, that reacts with water and turns a bright pink so we can tell how much water's down there, if there's any. And we also have a field analyzer. It's called a Zeltec machine. It's about the size of a shoebox. Mm-hmm. And you fill up kind of a large test tube, and it uses infrared technology to shoot into that. And we test, you know, the E10, the B5, octane level. So those are kind of the tools. We do check for proper labeling. Anything else that you can think of, Steve?
I think that covers a big line.
We're well, way beyond our technical knowledge right now. So
based on what we're seeing, we're to the best of our ability, we're meeting the spec.
I would suggest, and I'm sorry I don't have a name, that you might want to follow up. Whoever does gear at Portland that about that, because they had a major concern that was at a different fuel conference I was at. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say I was in charge of the IT for weights and measures for the County of Santa Barbara, and I can tell you that the counties in California have more staff than you have for the state.
Yeah, they've got a system there where each county has their own weights and measures program.
That's right.
Well, these programs are supposed to pay for themselves, so this puts us back in the right place. Okay, anybody?
I got a question.
Yes, you do.
Of course I do.
Yes, you do.
The question I have is that, you know, supposedly this has been supplemented by other ratepayers. Now that we're going to go to $10, is the money going to go the other way? You've doubled. I mean, you can say 20% per year, but you've doubled your fee. So are we going to be subsidizing other people with this fee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, so by making this program stand on its own, it allows us to go longer without raising the fees on the weights and measures part of our program, those scales and other measuring devices.
It wasn't quite the way I worded it, but so
the answer is yes.
I'm a courtesy yes anyway, so.
Yep. The answer is yes. All righty. Anybody else want to talk? We'll close public hearing. We'll open a work session. The chair moves Senate Bill 1. I got to get the right one here.
254. 254.
Oh, there it is. 254. I've got too many notes on my agenda. Senate Bill 254 to Senate Finance and, let's see, what is that? Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. With the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Well, that doesn't show a courtesy, yes.
Is there any opposition? Is there any opposition?
I have to vote on all that other stuff. You guys have to vote on all the fee increases.
The bill's moved to Senate Bill 254 is moved to Senate Finance and Revenue with a due pass recommendation. Senator Thompson is a no. We'll close on that. We'll open a work session on introduction of bills. The chair moves LC 1578 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? It's done. Senate LC 1578 is introduced. Anything else for the committee? We're adjourned. Else for the committee, we're adjourned.